Thanks so much. I'm very happy to be back. I never wanted to leave, really, but these days, the possibility of me spending a few weeks in a row at a workshop is in the small play. So, yeah, I can come up for a day very easily. So this is, and so the talk I gave a couple weeks ago was sort of in this vein too, and I tried to make it more discussion-oriented than normal talk, but I'll try not to be redundant, and of course this is officially a discussion, so it's up to you to take it where you want to take it. When I was here for that week, things were pretty lively, so I hope that I actually won't be doing so much talking. So when I was a kid, I used to read these Choose Your Own Adventure books, which I think is sort of a good model for these discussions. So there are a few different ways to organize this kind of topic, and three of them came to mind. So I'll ask you how you want to start it off. So I think it's possible to organize the discussion nicely by talking about space-time dimension, by articulating existing conjectures, or organizing it by some questions that I thought of that would then branch out into whatever it branches out into. So, does anyone have an opinion on this?
How was this the third?
Yeah.
Your ideas.
Very well. So,
my suggestion, I don't want to do.
I already, shot all my bullets a couple weeks ago about my ideas. Okay, so, I want your ideas. Okay. So one topic that I think is kind of overarching here is this question of string or M-theory universality. So, let's just something. So there are different versions of what you can mean by this. I think a weak version is and just to state this up front, I'm interpreting this as a mandate to talk about the swampland of ADS vacua. Although the question of what holography means outside of ADS is its own interesting thing that maybe we'll get to, but mostly I'll sort of orient it in the ADS TFT context. So a weak version of there being some kind of string or M-theory universality in holographic CFTs is that they have features which are consistent with what we know about string in M-theory. A strong version is that the bulk theories have to be string or M-theory. And I think sometimes there are pieces of evidence that point one way or the other. So on the weak side, things like the fact that CFT spectra have to organize themselves into families of operators, aka register trajectories, evokes the register trajectories of string theory. A kind of stronger version of this is something like the following. So in the conformal bootstrap for the 2-0 theories, there's some numerical results that establish that the minimum central charge for a 2-0 theory is C equals 25. And that's exactly the central charge for a theory of 2 M5 brains, which we already knew about from thinking about M theory. So that doesn't quite get you the strong version, saying that it has to be sort of M theoretic, but it's a little stronger than just saying there's some feature that looks a bit like M theory. Yeah.
So maybe I'm mistaken, but I thought that these regular trajectories that you get, the bulk interpretation is like two particle states, like going far out in the.
So
it's not a string in the bulk?
So the most rigorous statement is that a large spin, families of operators and CFTs, asymptotes to these double twist operators, which have this ADS interpretation that you just described. But the statement is more powerful than that, namely that at finite spin, above some low cutoff, every operator has to lie in a trajectory which asymptotes to one such trajectory. And at finite spin, there's no such interpretation. And this is also true about theories whether they're large end or finite end, so there's not necessarily a sort of single trace, double trace split. And so I think in that sense, it's there's not really a distinction. So the question here is sort of how far can this go? So one of the messages in the talk I gave a couple weeks ago is that I think the spectrum of operators where the dimensions are sort of intermediate between black holes and light states is important for understanding this kind of question, either things that are dual to string states or brains in the bulk. So now you might ask, can we bootstrap? And here, I mean, in a sort of general sense, D-brains. So for example, these would be operators where delta O is something like n in a theory with n squared degrees of freedom. And you show that such operators in certain situations, like a CFT with a large higher spin gap, must exist, so consistent with whatever principle. That's one version of this question. Likewise, we'd like to know maybe if M theory has stable Planckian degrees of freedom. And so these would also be operators, so primaries in the CFT whose dimensions scale with some power of n in a CFT with which has an M theory dual. I think we don't really know the answer to that. So let's say good. So this, of course, connects on to various conjectures that are out there, which we'll turn to shortly. But first, let me just open this question up to see what you're hoping. Or to ask what versions of this question appeal to you. So this is one version of this question.
So it's an outsider cosmologist. Yeah. I thought P0 brains for the fundamental degrees of freedom is not what you're getting at.
Well, what I'm getting at is that so string theory has a whole spectrum of D brains. And depending on the space-time dimension of the ADS vacuum or the CFT that you're talking about, there will be operators that are dual to D-brains of various dimension, maybe wrapped on cycles of some compact manifold or something. Without resorting to the holographic picture, can you show that these operators have to actually be there? And in that sense, these zero brains are not particularly special. They participate in a certain version of holographic duality, but other than that, they, I think from this perspective, aren't more special than, I don't know, D3 brains or something.
How close are we to actually using techniques of bootstrap to get answers to the questions that you're posing there?
Yeah, I think I'd say not so close in the sense that, so these are heavy. Well, I guess I call them hefty. They're pretty heavy operators. And so that means that if you're studying a four-point function, you need to look at the high dimension regime. Most of our tools are better for the large spin regime so far, or the asymptotically heavy regime where black holes lie. But you need to have, for example, if you want to do numerics and access this regime, you have to have really good numerical control to look at the spectrum, not just of lowest lying operators, but you know, pretty far up there. So I'd say we're not particularly close. Yeah.
So would it be easier to detect them in situations when they are becoming light?
Yeah. Yeah, that may be the case, especially when they're charged under some gauge field, which also comes along for the ride. Then you might try to resort to something like proving a kind of completeness condition for the for that gauge field, and then you'd infer the existence of these objects.
Are you imagining a scenario where you only have one weak coupling parameter, which is 1 over n, or are you imagining a scenario where you have like another weak coupling parameter where you could separate, say, a string scale from a Planck scale or something like that?
Both. I mean, the second one here and the first one here.
Yeah. Because it seems like if you only have a 1 over n as your small parameter, it seems hard to decide exactly what you mean. Like I don't even know exactly what to shoot for, right? I mean, maybe, sorry, it's a kind of vague question, but it seems like without an additional weak coupling parameter, it's hard to know exactly what you would even mean by a string or M-theory universality, right?
So, well, I think these two questions are more similar to each other than that. But because these are, you know, I'm not talking about string states.
I understand.
Yeah. You could.
Right.
And then you'd be making use of the fact that there's another parameter. But
yeah.
I think, you know, in theories that are, say, just purely M-theoretic, I think there's still, I mean, this question is perfectly well defined from the field theory point of view, but you have to contend with the fact that the 1 over n expansion competes with these kinds of contributions and find a way to go past that. But I think that's not
it. What criteria of these states would allow you to identify them as D-brains?
So let's just start with a criterion like
here's some strong code. Okay. So any state with dimension scaling like m.
Sure. This is pretty coarse, but it's a starting point.
But like, would you make her guess what their density of states is, or what their...
Good, yeah, so so let's add that to this.
In this convention, the black hole is n-squared, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, I can say. Really, I mean, you know, I think more generally, C to some number greater than zero is kind of what I mean. So it depends on the particular, I mean, in
dimension.
Yeah, exactly. Particular examples, it could be root C, it could be something else, depending on the internal manifold and so on. So you can ask questions about the density of states of the duals to string E and Planckian degrees of freedom. And here I guess I mean, I should be consistent in what language I'm using. You know, these might be like something which scales like delta gap, where this is the string scale. So I'm thinking about a theory with an N and a delta gap. So it's a family which has this parametric region where at large delta gap, you have Einstein gravity. And here, just to sort of say again, this is the higher spin gap, the gap to the lightest higher spin single trace operator. Whereas here, these are operators which are in this regime. So the kind of thing that you and your co-authors did in establishing this version of string universality in the 2D orbifolds was a statement about the density of states somewhere below here.
Yeah.
You didn't have to say where, but it's a version of string universality that you established, right?
You would write down a more general criteria, I guess. What criteria would you?
What criteria would you write down? Let's come to some criteria. So why don't we start with what you all established in that paper?
I mean, we just said something very general, which is that if there's a region where you have perturbative stringy degrees of freedom, then there's some region where you have a Hagedorn spectrum.
Yeah.
But that's a pretty strong requirement. And I don't know if you expect that, you know, if you don't have a separation between the string scale and the Planck scale, you wouldn't necessarily expect that.
Do we always make a Hagedorn spectrum, like in Medius 4, process 7, right? M theory, pure M theory.
Yeah, I mean, in general, it would be much more complicated. Right? We were looking at very simple classes of 2D CFTs where it happened to be true.
So you had a condition sort of like this, for you, you were trying to include M-theory as well, so there was a 10 11ths, but let's just go with the stringy example. You want some Hagedorn growth somewhere below some delta star, where delta star is some scale which is below the Planck scale.
But I don't know if we can do... Yeah.
So this is one condition, but...
For delta large, presumably.
Yeah, that's right. So let's... let me get rid of that. So it's large, and it's, let's write this a little better.
But there's no condition of what is delta
out. Right, I think the condition that you guys proposed was pretty general, just somewhere below the Planck scale, that place depending on the details.
Yeah, I mean, we were looking at states that didn't scale with C.
Right.
You, I mean, if you wanted to look at D-brain states, they would scale with C in some way. And then you could expect a much richer structure.
Yeah.
So can I ask you a question about this deep brain states? So can you sort of put it in by hand in some sense? If you study like a defect CFT, were you imagining that that's some deep brain that's doing that, that comes to the boundary? So can you learn something from that, or is, yeah, it's a completely different...
Well, if you're trying to address the sort of taxonomic problem of whether, how many theories have these states, whether they have to be there, whether they can be there, I'm not sure. I mean, including something like that would be constructing a class of examples where they are there. But going something further, saying something like, given a CFT, you can always, you know, put some conformal defect and interpret it as a D-brain, then that's getting closer to saying something universal about their existence, but I'm not sure if that's what you meant.
Well, I just thought, I mean, you could put it in by hand and maybe try to learn something. I don't know, maybe because you put it in hand, you don't, by hand, you don't learn anything.
Right, so here you have in mind learning something about the way, their
charges
properties.
Right.
Yeah, so I guess that would be sort of a, not so much an existence proof, but a, if they exist, what do they look like?
Right.
And then maybe amassing evidence for them being dual to D-brains. Yeah.
Suppose that one can show that you can consistently couple a conformal defect like this, then wouldn't you say that, I mean, it was like the D-brain at the boundary, so if you can have it at the boundary, then you could have it at the bulk, so there should be an actual dynamical local operator in the theory. So a related picture to that one, related more to the strong version or the string universality, like is really everything connected to string theory or theory? Like one way that you can think about that in the bulk is like Jake and Goodman were doing is like, you know, if anything that is connected to M theory, there has to be a domain wall that allows you to go from any phase to any other phase. Mm-hmm. So if you take that domain wall in the ADX context and push it all the way to the boundary, that becomes a conformal interface between the two CFTs. So then a question, one way you could phrase in a precise way the question of strong string M theory universality is there a conformal, transmissible conformal interface between any two CFTs? And I don't know the answer. Does anybody know any obstruction to that? Because are there any two CFTs that we know for sure cannot have a transmissible conformal interface?
Our argument is not necessarily have conformality in terms of the interface itself.
Right, but when you push, whatever domain wall you have, you push it to the boundary, it's going to be a conformal interface.
What sort of bootstrap techniques in particular do you imagine being most useful for these sorts of problems?
I don't know.
I mean, so there's like 4-point bootstrap, there's thermal bootstrap, there's Lorentzian arguments, there's Euclidean arguments, there's a zoo right now. So what do people think?
So far, I mean, it's easiest to answer that by just saying why what we have so far seems insufficient. The Lorentzian techniques seem, they're most well suited to analyzing the large spin regime and analyzing constraints on higher spin degrees of freedom. Because in the Regi limit, the scaling is sensitive to the spin, and you can use Regi arguments or causality arguments to make connections between the presence of higher spin particles and other features of the theory. But here, that's not what we're asking. So I don't immediately see how causality type arguments help address this question, or some others which we'll get to, actually. Thermal bootstrap, I'd say, is pretty young, and it's not totally obvious what that will lead to. It doesn't have the built-in positivity property that the 4-point bootstrap does, in the sense that unless you look at... So if you look at low-point thermal correlators, then you have an expansion in objects which are not squared OPE coefficients, And so if something's linear on LP coefficients, it doesn't have to be positive.
Something like modular bootstraps, which does have positivity, which is a kind of thermal bootstrap.
Yeah,
So I have a question about the relationship between the Lorentzian technique and the Euclidean techniques. What is the logical relation between the two? Are they logically independent? Should I think of the Lorentzian techniques as a very, very smart way of rephrasing the constraints that I get from just crossing symmetry and reflection positive in the Euclidean picture in some language that makes some constraints which are not manifest in the Euclidean picture manifest? Or is there any new ingredient in the Lorentzian picture that is additional on top of reflection positivity and crossing?
I don't think it's just a revealing things that you could eventually discover by Euclidean.
So then what is the new principle?
I'm not as expert on that as many other people. So the reason I say that is because, well, so to take one example, so this Lorentzian inversion formula is a famous development of the last few years. Yeah. And so the word Lorentzian is in there. Mm-hmm. And there's a Euclidean inversion formula that you can formally write down, given some four-point function to extract the OPE data from it. That formula is not manifestly analytic in spin, the Lorentzian one is, and going between the two requires a contour deformation that, while I think guaranteed to exist, given axioms of CFT or something like them, still tells you something new. Mm-hmm. I mean, on the other hand, you might just say, well, if Lorentzian correlators can always be obtained as analytic continuations of Euclidean correlators, then, well, in that sense, are you learning something new or not? I just don't actually have such a good grasp on the axiomatic perspective, but I sort of find that, I don't know.
You clearly learn
that. Until someone reveals a way in which the Euclidean formalism can be used to learn the same things, I'm not sure how useful it is, but...
Where does the large charge bootstrap fit into this?
Where does it fit in to this kind of question?
Yeah.
So I think that's a good question, actually.
It's like the weak gravity conjecture.
That's right.
Q.
Yeah, so we were looking a little bit into that direction. So, for instance, Susanne, the Bern group, they have a paper trying to relate large charge bootstrap to weak gravity conjecture. So basically, you know, they get that charge to match. This expression they get for the lowest dimension of the component, you know, of the lowest dimension of the operator in the large charge sector, is consistent with the expression for a Rice-Anderson black hole.
No, it's not.
Yeah, they get
in three dimensions.
In four dimensions, they get the delta. So they have a three-dimensional CFT, and they have like different universality classes. One of them is supersymmetric. Then they get delta equals Q. With a supersymmetry, they get delta goes like Q to the 3/2, which is the expression for the mass to charge relation of an extreme Rice-Anderson black hole in ADS, Einstein-Maxwell.
Okay, I heard otherwise, but okay, sure.
Yeah, in any case, they have this, they kind of put in some assumptions, like, you know, you need to have a spontaneous symmetry breaking of the charge in the large charge sector, which is not so clearly happening, for instance, for a black hole. So.
I think, if I'm not remembering which reference, but there was somebody who was talking about the relation between weak gravity, conjecture, and holography, not in the context of holography per se, but in the context of conformal field theories, which don't necessarily have holographic dual. Mm. And so I think the people try to find counterexamples for conformal field theories, and they could find, because those are the ones with the obstructions to have a large holographic dual. In other words, there's no problem a priori to try to find, in a given conformal theory, a counterstatement to the weak gravity conjecture, because there's no gravity in that sense.
That's
related to, possibly relating to, an obstruction criteria for CFTs to have holographic tool.
Yeah, I think this is the paper by Nakayama and Nomura.
Yes, thank you. That's
it. Yeah. So there are some examples.
There's some related papers by Shamet as well.
The 2D charge modulo
is the 2D. The 2D CFT papers.
So are these violations large or are they small?
So the point is that you can find operators. So you first write down what is the constraint of the dimensions on the charge that would gradually imply. You just read it off from, you know, Bajo physics or whatever, and then you just randomly try to apply to any safety. There are counter examples where all of them are small.
In what dimension?
Or in 4 or 5 dimensions.
It's 40, I think.
Yeah, but this, yeah, that's right. But they never, this, the CFTs for which you can find a counter example, I forget if they're just a small n or they are large n, but they have like, they're kind of like Basili, they have like bad strings. You don't want to expect with rise to the whole in those anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like that doesn't deserve to be called a counter example because it's not in
the right. They're not counter examples, but it's actually interesting for photography in the sense that a swamp land condition will put an obstruction on a safety to have holographic domain. That would be that another way of asking it.
You're probably not going to be able to prove with gravity in the bootstrap without assuming something. You have to build in Einstein's gravity somehow.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So that actually, maybe we can move to a related topic, which that touches on, which is, I like to talk about this topic, but it's, it's really a kind of subcase, if you like, of the first question. So, Fred, I mean, apparently, if you take that sequence of theory that you're just talking about, and you try to ask whether you can take it to strong coupling in the sense of a large higher spin gap, maybe there's some obstruction to doing that, which you could rephrase as a statement about violating weak gravity conjecture in such a, in, you know, the such limit can't exist, is the same thing as saying that weak gravity is violated to the extent that weak gravity implies something about the spectrum of large and large gap CFTs. So more generally, we know lots of properties about what seems to emerge in CFTs at large higher spin gap. I'll sort of list some of them. This is something that's been discussed a bit already, but not everyone was around. So things that seem to be emergent. So the first thing that is kind of obvious right here, large higher spin gap and large n, we know that bulk Einstein gravity seems to emerge in this limit, and with that comes maximal chaos some kind of, you know, absence of higher spin particles by construction, but there are sort of more subtle things that I think we want to talk about. So one of them, and here I'm going to list things that seem to be emerging in a large gap, and we can talk about whether they really are. Is this question about whether there exist non-supersymmetric CFTs that emit such limits. Let's just stop there.
It might be amenable to like Lorentzian bootstrap analysis, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
What do you say?
Yeah.
No idea? Something in you wanted to say that.
It's fair.
Yeah.
No, I mean that means.
Sorry, can you repeat the claim you made about non-SUSY CFTs? I missed it.
So here I'm evoking the Gourevafa conjecture that there are no stable non-supersymmetric ADS vacua in bulk theories that contain an Einstein gravity subsector coupled to a finite amount of light matter. And in CFT language, that's the statement that if you have a sequence of theories that have large n and a large higher spin gap in the limit, that they must be supersymmetric. There are arguments for this that are quite appealing. So I think, you know, something close to a type of first principles argument is that this slight modification of the weak gravity conjecture leads to this implication. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you might say that there might be some special exceptions to this. This was discussed a couple weeks ago, which involve constructions that secretly rely on there being supersymmetric brains involved. The kind of intuition for that argument doesn't apply. Whether that's true, I don't know. I think we should try to establish this more rigorously. I think actually one...
Just related to just that comment, I want to say there are examples of something like that, where actually finishing a work which says something to that effect, that in supersymmetric theories, not in the non-supersymmetric case, but in supersymmetric theories, the quantities that are possibly corrected, like superpotential in n equals to 1 or prepotential in n equals to 2, they always get corrected, except when they have a hidden connection with the higher supersymmetric theory. So this, we have examples where this is protected by a higher supersymmetric theory, and indeed something like that. So the motivation of trying to find the counterexample to the condition we have with Hiroshi would potentially be of that type. Though, and we fail to find any examples in this coming work to show that non-supersymmetric one would have any kind of protection by the supersymmetric, by having a pseudo connection with the supersymmetric theory. So, but still be interesting to study. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's and maybe sort of as a subpoint.
The arguments where you fail to find something.
No. Or at least more than that. Yeah. To show that all the examples people thought had no corrections, had corrections, and the only ones which could not rule out the example was affected by it. So it's more than just. You just
have
that two or three examples.
So, right. So I think that Liam, in the answers workshop, he gave, I think, a very concrete example of what probably is a special exception to this kind of thing in two dimensions. You're taking it to the CFT with 2U1 currents, like that movie in a red movie, which is supersymmetric, perhaps. And then there's always an exactly marginal deformation, which is just JJ bar. This is, you know, this is something of it exactly, and there are examples where this thing is actually, you know, pretty supersymmetric completely, right? So that's, you know, technically that's a counterexample. But the deformation in this particular case is so simple, right? It's just, you know, we know exactly what the OPU with the current with every state is controlled by its charge, so it looks like kind of like a little bit like changing boundary conditions, but not really changing the box so much.
You'd have to flow a long way, though. Yeah.
No, but this is a marginal deformation. This is
but how the dimensions look, yeah.
Yeah, but the point is that the dimensions are in any
You're saying it stays stable because
it's... So that one's stable. I think that the bulk is more or less the same. The point is that in ADS3CFT2, the dimensions of the dual CFT, precisely when you have U1 charges, they are not related in such a simple way with masses and states in the bulk because there's the boundary terms in the ADS, right?
Boundary terms are a way to, I mean, Eric already pointed out this, I guess.
Right, he's also right.
Boundary effects can break supersymmetry, and there are the strong. Nobody says that in a supersymmetric ADS CFT you cannot put a defect near the boundary or effectively change the boundary condition to break supersymmetry.
Right.
That's certainly possible.
I think if this is true, then it indicates something else interesting, which we should understand. So independently, there is this bound in, so let me state this in 4D CFTs. So if you take the difference of central charges A and C and divide by C, and this has been proven to be bounded above by 1 over the higher spin gap squared. This is the result by Kems. Okay. Now, in superconformal theories, this is too weak because A doesn't depend on. So, first, just let's view delta gap as a proxy for the coupling, exactly marginal coupling, which, generally speaking, in all known examples, it is, for example, controlled by lambda and A equals 4, and so on. So, that tends to be how we think of this. Let's view delta gap as an exactly marginal coupling of sorts, which is becoming large in the holographic limit. Now, A doesn't depend on such couplings, and neither does C if they're supersymmetry. So actually, this thing is bounded above by something which, if there are no non-supersymmetric CFTs, must actually be much smaller. So in top-down examples, this is bounded above by some power of n. In other words, A equals C at leading order, but there's a one-loop correction. Which depends, so the scaling, this number is either, I mean, schematically it's 1 for open string bulk duals or 2 for closed string bulk duals, where C goes like n squared in that statement. So, if there are no non-supersymmetric CFTs, then actually something like this should be true instead.
So it doesn't depend on lambda as well, like the top?
What, it doesn't, does this depend on lambda?
So the intuition is delta gap is like the string scale, and for instance, in the course of a male, there's this
lambda to the 1/4.
That's what you're saying. Yeah, so you're just writing the independence.
Right. Yeah, think of this as lambda to some power.
Okay.
So then, if there's supersymmetry, these don't depend on such couplings, so this bound should be much tighter. So that would be And there's something to be learned there. And an idea, just a sort of comment about trying to address this, is to back off this a little bit and think about a slightly easier problem. So can you first show that you need fermions? So forget about supersymmetry, just imagine the bulk. Often we just talk about the bosonic truncation doing classical questions, but can you show you actually need fermions in the bulk, which would be due to the fermionic primary operators? Then, you know, step one might be this, step two might be, okay, well, let's show actually you need a gravitino, a spin 3/2 primary, which has the quantum numbers of an operator dual to a gravitino, and then you're on your way to showing that supersymmetry has to be there. But first, if you study this problem about do you need fermions in the bulk, even classically for some reason, or semi-classically, that goes some way toward trying to establish this. Maybe it's worth thinking about.
Talked about in this context by starting with the higher ADS, would-be ADS CFD, and try to compact, try them circles, and try to see if fermions would be relevant and important for that. I mean, what have people done in that family? This is related to some work that Irene and company are doing, which relates to, I don't want to say anything about it, but it sounds, by relating different dimensions, they predict the existence of fermions of a given mass in the context of would-be this setup. So I'm just trying to see if there's an analogous effort in the ADS case.
I don't think so. I don't think there's a study of this from a kind of bottom-up type perspective, of the type you're advocating or asking about. I'm not sure.
So can we learn anything about fermions from the CFT side? Like, it seems difficult, right? Because we just, the neural vector model doesn't have fermions, right? But that's also not Einstein, so.
Right. And you would need to look at more than just four-point functions of scalar operators. You know, fermions don't appear in the intermediate channel. So, that's an example of why it's not immediately obvious what to do, because you don't want to put them in, you want to show that they have to be there,
right,
by working with the bosonic objects that you surely have.
There cannot be a general argument that these things are right, because the O-M vector model, I think, doesn't have...
So this has got to be crucial to that.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and that's the question. Why, when you can construct all sorts of theories that might be free or weakly interacting, that have whatever properties you want, is it that when you go to strong coupling by taking the large higher spin gap, there are such strong constraints? right? I mean, so you can make a theory with A equals C out of free fields, mm-hmm, but that doesn't tell you anything about these questions. Good. Now, there's a result here which I actually think... So let's move on from the non-supersymmetric story.
A question regarding that. If you prove two, couldn't you still have a spontaneity broken supersymmetry at a high scale in the bulk?
Yeah, so that could potentially, if there's a counterexample of that I found, secrets to Z would be related to your comment that in some sense there's to Z, but it's broken, and so forth. In some sense there's a massive gravity. You know?
But sorry, if we have secret Susie, doesn't that mean that we have a fermionic operator of very high dimension, perhaps? But there are fermionic operators.
Yeah, that's what he's
saying. Secret Susie would
fit with that problem. It would fit with secret Susie.
Thanks.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So there was a result in a paper by Panadonis, Silva, and Jaboyedov from a couple months ago, which Miguel brought up in my talk, and I didn't get a chance to bring it up, ran out of time, but it fits in here well. So they, using the Mellin space CFT methods, actually proved a kind of sum rule, which they say proves the following result. So if you have some scalar phi, minimally coupled to gravity, to Einstein gravity, then there's a certain range of conformal dimensions which are in the swamp land. regardless of almost all other couplings in the bulk, with one exception, which I'll get to in a second. So in general, so they look at the cases D equals 3 and 4 explicitly, but the bound, which is ruled out, is of the following form. So a scalar conformal weight is bounded below by D minus 2 over 2 by unitarity. So if you take the unitarity bound and add some order 1, some small number, which I'm just going to call epsilon here, so I don't have to quote it, then they showed, using this kind of sum rule, that this range of conformal dimensions is ruled out.
And I should understand that when d is equal to 2, there's no such bound.
Yeah, they were looking at d greater than 2. That's right.
And they don't have any, it just doesn't apply, or they just didn't look at it?
Both, I think. Surely the result doesn't apply in its current form, but I don't know if there are analogous results.
I apologize for my ignorance, but one problem with light scalars, one feature of light scalars is that if you look at extremal black holes, which have a near horizon ADS2 region, then a sufficiently light scalar can lead to a holographic superconducting conductivity, even if it's not charged, right? Is that ruled out by this now?
You mean, does that range coincide with this range?
So
that range, I mean, so the simplest version of that is when you have a scalar which goes below the ADS2 BF bound in your horizon, but otherwise is stable.
I'm wondering if that 3/4 D minus 2 is.
We have to do some algebra, which is dangerous.
Yeah, I just don't remember.
Yeah, so I think this can happen for a massless scalar, right? You just have a massless scalar that is enough so that the near horizon.
No, massless is stable in any number of dimensions. It has to be tachyonic. I just don't remember. One needs to look up the formulas.
Okay,
how delta phi is related to mass.
Let's try to do this, which is bound to be embarrassing, but
my internet's not working, I can't help you.
Okay, so there's the BF bound in ADS2. Right, so now we need to take masses. Take this and translate it into higher dimensional conformal weights, and that's the part I'm not going to do. But at least this is the starting point. Okay. So you can fire up your maple and
So epsilon is something. Wait.
Epsilon is some small number which is not parametrically small. It's just some order one number. So for example, in d equals 3, it's like 0.1.
It's not known analytically.
Correct. I think it is known analytically, excuse me. It's known analytically, yeah. So they have some rule with an explicit kind of kernel, and only some terms contribute to violation, and they're just basically ratios of gamma functions.
So what is the restriction that they're imposing?
Sorry, one more comment. Maybe it's not known analytically, maybe it's some transcendental equation, but I just need to look more carefully.
So what is the condition that they're imposing to get?
So this sum rule follows somewhat mysteriously from something they call the Polyakov condition that they impose on Mellin amplitudes, which morally is the statement that the conformal partial wave decomposition should just include conformal partial waves and a tree level in the bulk, maybe their derivatives, but not more than that. And so, in other words, higher derivatives, say, it should, in other words, have a well-defined conformal partial wave decomposition. And from this, there's some rules that emerge. And if you look at the contributions of different operators in some tree-level theory in ADS, you have single traces, you have double traces, and almost all the double traces, in addition to stuff which is parametrically heavy, gives a positive contribution to this sum rule. And you can set up an equation where all that contributes is some finite set of double trace operators whose anomalous dimensions depend on delta phi, and you violate the sum rule unless delta phi is outside of this window.
Okay. And if it's not minimally coupled?
I don't think they actually say anything about that. but...
So then you could get any mass then?
I mean, we'd have to think more about how they're... what to do with
it. It's only minimal.
That seems like a super artificial thing, actually.
So, well, no, but if you're working in a theory where from the beginning you say it's got a large higher spin gap, then the minimal coupling, I mean, it sort of comes for free because everything else is suppressed. And that's the regime we often are working in, right? So Einstein gravity coupled to scalar. Implicit in that is that, say, higher derivative couplings between the scalar and the metric are suppressed by powers of the gap. So in this limit, we don't consider those. It's not supposed to be more radical than that.
Also, they really are not really not the range of masses, right? They're really not the range of the masses with a certain boundary condition.
Good. Yeah, so let's talk about... So I have three comments about this, which I think the authors are aware, and they're not sort of, you know, severe comments, but the first is that... Right, so this is in a range where you take the alternate boundary condition for a bulk scalar. So actually, if you read it in terms of the mass and the bulk, no masses are ruled out. It just says if you have masses in a certain range, such that this choice is allowed, naively, you actually can't make this choice. You have to pick the standard boundary condition. Okay. So it's not really a restriction on the masses of a bulk Lagrangian. In that sense, it's not a bulk swampland condition. The second comment is actually that d phi to the fourth coupling contributes. And so when they write this result, they are not including this coupling. But if you add it, it actually can take the scalar in this range and make it okay. So really, I think you should think of this constraint as a bound on the coupling lambda of such a d phi to the fourth coupling.
So
in particular, lambda is bounded below by some number which is order 1 in Planck units. So if there's a n squared in front of the action, and then there's a lambda d phi to the fourth, then lambda has to be bounded below by order 1 if a scalar in this range is to be allowed.
So the coupling has to be strong, like...
It has to be turned on.
It has to be turned on. If it's turned off...
Then you're back to this.
Okay, right. So you're saying that, right, if the coupling is bigger for order 1, then this doesn't matter.
Yeah, that is my understanding, and Alex is nodding, so that's good.
Well, it's some order 1 constraint in effective field theory, right?
Yeah, but...
Like, you would naturally expect this to be order 1, and this is some bound on that order 1 coefficient?
No,
is that right?
I don't think so. No, so I think this is interesting because...
Bigger, it's stronger than that?
Because, so this is true as a statement about their sum rule. On the other hand, there's been a lot of work establishing that the derivative expansion, the bulk, is always suppressed by powers of delta gap, which here is large. Mm-hmm. So lots of couplings, like, you know, d to the 2n, phi to the 4th, have been shown to be suppressed by appropriate powers of delta gap that you'd guess from dimensional analysis. This one has actually evaded that kind of analysis because it only gives rise to spin 2 OPE data in the DFC-FT decomposition, and a lot of our Lorentzian kinds of arguments don't rule things out that involve just spin 2 or below. So actually, this coefficient has not been proven to be suppressed by two powers of delta gap, but I believe it is, and it's important to show that. Because if you can show that, then their sum rule becomes powerful again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, what is the sign around that? Should it be positive?
So, in the presence of gravity, not necessarily. If you turn off gravity, then it is constrained to be sign definite. Yeah. Good. So, think of the sum rule as a kind of bound on lambda, but it's inconsistent with this other statement about effective field theory that we think is true. So it's important to try to prove that this is suppressed by delta gap like we think it is. And then the third comment is that this actually seems to put a constraint on the kinds of superconformal representations that can appear in large gap theories. So for example, in 4D, if you take an n equals 1 theory, chiral primaries have a dimension 3/2 times the U1R charge, and 3/2 is the upper bound here, So if this argument we just described goes through, then actually the R charge is bounded below by 1 in any theory that has a large gap limit. That's interesting, and I think a new result.
Sorry, so where's the... So you're bounded below by 1, but where's the charge quantum for
R? Yeah, so that right, I think that needs to be thought about more carefully, but it's something that... Right, so whether that's a non-trivial statement or not involves thinking about that
all right. carefully. So another thing that I thought was interesting is that in deriving that strong rule, so they have a strong rule which is manifestly positive for operators with high twist. It's delta minus L, right? One could imagine, I mean, I don't know of any examples, but I don't see why it wouldn't be possible to imagine, you know, have some theory in which you have some very high dimension operator, something like a string state or something, which actually has very low twist. If you have something like this, it could also evade the bound. I don't know of an example.
Sorry, people probably can't see down here, right? I'm stop writing down here. Yeah. I just wrote what you just said, so you know. Is there another question?
Can I go back to the second point?
Yeah.
So could this Planckian degrees of freedom be helpful to make this lambda? So if you keep the gap to infinity, but if you consider finite end, maybe such a Planckian degrees of freedom could help the second point.
I think that if you really want to go to finite n at large gap, that's not a sensible thing to do, because delta gap is always bounded above by some power of the central charge by n. So you're never really supposed to be able to do that. This is like saying that there's, in string theory, a duality frame where the string scale and Planck scale are ordered. So I'm not sure that's really possible.
Positive and bigger number.
Yeah, in some conventions.
This is what they claim.
Okay, good. So, right. Other aspects of large gap universality were discussed a couple weeks ago. Now, there are some obvious things that we haven't talked about yet. So some question that falls into both of these categories is this question about whether you need to have parametrically large extra dimensions in the bulk dual of a large gap theory. I think let's call this the ADS distance conjecture. This has surely been discussed more since I left, so maybe we don't need to dive all the way in, and everyone knows what this is. I think a related question is whether, now let's make a little heading. So let's think about that more carefully. Another question is whether symmetries, in particular, global symmetries of the CFT, have anything to do with this question?
So, can you cite what this ADS distance conjecture is?
Yes. So, the ADS distance conjecture is the statement that, as you, given some family radius vacua parameterized by the cosmological constant, as you take the cosmological constant to zero, there is a tower of states which are becoming massless at some power law in lambda. That's the weak version. The strong version is that they're becoming massless with a particular power, namely 1/2, which is just the statement that geometrically, if you have extra dimensions, they are of order the ADS scale. So m of these particles is of order 1 over L ADS. That is to say, they're KK modes on some macroscopic internal manifold.
So does that imply Minkowski space is a good solution to string theory?
No. So that this is conjecture applied to particular solutions. So that it shows if the ADSC conjecture is true, it means that ADS is infinitely far away from Minkowski, even if lambda is not. In other words, lambda is not a good measure of how close you are to Minkowski. So the distance from going, if you try to compute the metric distance between lambda equals 0 and lambda equals 2,
minus a topological transition, I guess.
So you don't learn anything about it. In fact, we do know that Minkowski space does have. It has no problem getting compact from a Calabi-Yau with zero cosmological constant.
Yeah, so in all of the... So let's just throw away the non-supersymmetric ADS conjecture for a second. So you might imagine you have some CFT, which maybe has global symmetries, maybe it doesn't. There's a question of whether that is related to whether there are large extra dimensions or not. So if you believe in something like a kind of completeness conjecture, then you might say, well, without a charge lattice to fill, why would there be states there? I mean, that's the most hand-wavy version of this kind of thing. But a sort of precise conjecture along those lines is that any time you have large extra dimensions, there are some global symmetries in the CFT. And if you think the CFT has to be supersymmetric, then there should be some continuous R symmetries, which are in a sense sort of holding up this manifold for you. That's not been established, but it's in the same ballpark. I think that's really interesting. I'm trying to think about it. Good, and so obviously this has implications for trying to show whether string and M theory always have to emerge, because if you always have to have lots of large extra dimensions, well, that's a hallmark of string theory. And if you can't have too many large extra dimensions, well, that's a hallmark of string theory too. Good. One comment I'll make, maybe for an idea going forward, is to understand this. Rather, whether this case...
When you said symmetries, you mean, just to make sure I understand, you're trying to put a bound on symmetries or what?
So I mean, I'm trying to ask whether global symmetries in a CFT are associated with the existence of large extra dimensions in the bulk. Not necessarily a bound on them, but
so
whether their existence is tied to that.
Arbitrarily big gauge groups with no particular bound on dimensions, so I'm not sure what you mean.
Yeah, so there are cases where you have so I think it's not something you're going to be able to say that's always true, but I think there are versions of this statement that might always be true.
So let me give you a counterexample. I want to know how you think about that context. So take ADS 7 times S4 and mod up by Zn, and take n to be large. So Zn acting on this S4 to have north and south pole fixed points. So you get An singularity, An minus 1 singularity at the north and the south poles, giving gauge symmetries of SUn times SUn in the ADS 7 bulk. And so you can get an arbitrarily large dimension is fixed. So what in that context, what is it that you'd be saying?
I'm not sure that... I think that's a good reason to be suspicious that symmetries are always associated with large extra dimensions. I agree. But let's think about the other way. So are those large extra dimensions always geometrizing some symmetry? And then in that case,
that's a good question.
Different. Yeah. So you can ask about the arrow running either way. I think that's the way in which it's a little more conservative.
Using emergent diffeomorphism in extra dimensions, for example. Where is that? It's CFT language.
Yeah.
Because a priori ADS CFT doesn't see extra dimensions. So in other words, I see. So you're saying that the prediction of ADC, exactly, I see. So you're saying that there's emergent diffeomorphism symmetries in the sense that if it's large, then you can see movement in the higher dimensions.
Yeah, that's the way to put it.
And there's no such thing as a priori, you're saying, the CFT.
Is it possible to make a sharp statement about in which corners ADC is proven from the CFT point of view? So in particular, I was thinking about all situations with more than 4 supercharges, because from a string theory point of view, at least, there's not even a suggestion on how to get ADS vacua with scale separation. And the same goes for
all ADS vacua above four dimensions. I think the two problems are related probably. But so I was wondering, do you know from the CFT point of view whether we can make a sharp statement that ADC is proven for at least a given amount of supercharges or dimensions?
No, I don't. So there's this sort of exotic n equals 4 super Yang Mills question. I shouldn't call it super Yang Mills. You know, even in the case of four-dimensional n equals 4 SCFT, we don't know if the super Yang Mills theory is the unique one. If it were, then knowing the existence of the bulk solution would tell you that n equals 4 supersymmetry is enough to know that there are large extra dimensions, but we don't know if that's true. So take away some of that supersymmetry and we know even less. And I think in CFT language, it's a statement about the growth of operators that are charged under the R symmetry, whether you have a tower or whether you don't. I don't know any general results that say you have to have such a tower, but they seem to be there. Yeah, I mean, that's what's non-trivial about this kind of question. Saying that, say, R symmetries are geometrized, well, that gives you a nice mechanism for realizing the symmetry of the CFT, but it comes with all the operators that are charged under it along the way. And that's not obvious as a statement about symmetry, and maybe isn't necessarily true, but maybe it is. Okay, so I was just going to offer that, you know, maybe a fruitful thing to think about here is relates to some other folklore, which is that that of whether you can have a finite number of massive spin 2s at the classical level in some theory of gravity. So there's been some folklore in the supergravity literature for a while that you can't consistently truncate some KK tower of spin 2s down to some finite number of massive spin 2s interacting with Einstein gravity. That's a statement not just about the existence of the towers, but about the OPE amongst these operators. Consistent truncation requires that right, you can set a bunch of fields to zero, and therefore the three-point couplings must not be linear in the fields that you're turning off. But proving whether that folklore is actually true would come to bear on this because massive spin 2s are a signature of large extra dimensions. So massive spin 2s with order 1 masses in particular. So there's a few different versions of this conjecture that you can, this sort of folklore that exists. The first is that every such large gap CFT has to have such a tower. That would follow from this. The second is that if you have one massive spin 2, you have to have an infinite tower. It's a little weaker. And the third is a statement about consistent truncation. If you have a tower, can you truncate to some of them? And that last one, and only that last one, involves the OPE. So I think maybe thinking about this from the CFT perspective might be fruitful. So that's just a comment. Good. So let's see.
It started at 10:30.
Okay, good. Should I aim to wrap it soon, or what's the...
I can't see how the discussion goes. I think the 12-page of the discussion could stop earlier, could go all the way to 12:30.
So, before maybe making a suggestion for where to go, someone in the audience should perhaps direct where to go.
I think it's there any prospect also to check in something similar to the usual Swampland distance conjecture in ADS-CFT? Something
that plays an important role in complexity cases, but has never been addressed in holography. Right. So I guess it's difficult to
communicate
in space. I don't
know how. Can you phrase what the analog is that you have in mind? Yeah, so
take conformal field theory, which
has a marginal deformation. Yeah. You want to know that, first of all, there's a notional distance in that space. And secondly, as you go far in that distance space, in that moduli space, you always get like tower dimension operators in that.
Yeah.
So that's the CFT version of that statement.
Yeah.
Is that true?
I've been thinking about that, and maybe we can discuss. I don't know, but
this would be distant with respect to Zamolodi cosmology.
Yeah, exactly. So there is a metric on the distant decomposable field theory, a moduli space, and then using that, can you actually, if there's a counterexample, then you would say that would have been an obstruction. And if this distance conjecture is correct, that would be an obstruction to embedding it. But if you have holographic dual, then you test on that statement. So is there a general principle for CFTs for this to happen? Or which class of CFTs would this always have?
Well, I think, right. So this is absolutely an interesting question. Let me just make one comment first, which is the connection to holography is not totally clear. I think there are different versions you can formulate where holography does and doesn't have something to do with it. So, you know, it depends what kind of point you imagine going to. Strongly coupled or weakly coupled, say.
Strongly coupled or weakly coupled. You mean, for example, it could be tau n equals to Fourier Mills, is that, for example? In that case, you have nothing to say for tau very small, for example.
Yeah, that's right. In that case, I don't. Well, right, or just lambda and the TUF limit of n equals 4, then, you know, if you are making some statement about small lambda, then there's not a connection to this, but it still might be an analogy that is interesting as a statement about conformal manifolds.
Sorry, you didn't see how you would agree with that. Why would you not say, if n is large,
yeah.
It still has a connection, what do you mean?
I mean, if you're thinking about the region where lambda is small, then you're way outside of the Einstein gravity regime and the bulk dual.
Oh, yeah, no, that's for sure.
And so in that sense, so this doesn't...
There's a question, first of all, for CFD in its own right.
Yes.
Whether or not so gravity.
Yeah, that's on dual.
Which will apply also to that case. For large n, what happens when you have a very steady value, which we know is a contract derivative, and we have a tower of state because n is larger than whatever. We can be third dimensional. And then the question would be, okay, whether it has gravity implications or not, that's the second question. Whether it's an obstruction to embedding in gravity or whether that statement means that second. But then, yeah, the question is, I think, interesting regardless for CFT.
So I've actually been thinking about this precisely this question for a while with John Stout, which is Amsterdam. No? So there's maybe a way we thought there could be a way to try to argue for this in general from the point of view of CFT. So there was this paper by Conor Behan in 2017 where he wrote down flow equations for the dimensions and the three-point function coefficients under any exact marginal deformation. So there's just some flow equations. If you have any marginal deformation, like the GS in integral for Supreme Mills, then if you were able to solve those equations, you would be able to see this kind of effects, right? And the Swan-Dunning-Distance conjecture in this context is a statement about what happens to the solutions to those equations close to fixed points. Because, you know, when you have first order equation, and you flow far away, you're always close to fixed points. So the idea is that basically made by imposing crossing symmetry, these equations at the fixed point and large n, maybe you can say something along the lines. But I think that what is happening in these examples is that when you go far out, maybe a version of some distance conjecture stated in CFT terms is that whenever you take a marginal deformation and go far away, you end up in some sort of free point, right? Like you get a what happens in your first premium means when you go to zero coupling is the theory is becoming free, and then there's actually theorems in the CFT side telling you that you must have this tower of state of operators coming back.
So related to that, this
is something I'm kind of looking at with my. So in terms of kind of where you've got moduli stabilized vacua, where you've got something like the large volume scenario, where you've got kind of basically, you know, a parametric set of solutions in ADS space that are kind of reaching out to infinite volume. So you can, you know, if you view these from say assuming you've got some kind of holographic description of these, then if you view these from a CFT point, you can turn the Swan-Dunning distance conjecture. It's kind of, you know, it kind of turned to a statement that things like the KK masses are all getting lighter as you go to a larger volume, which is then a statement about the sign of the three-point coupling between the volume modulus and the two KK modes. So from a CFT perspective, you can basically trace this into a statement about anomalous dimensions in terms of the anomalous dimensions of, for example, the double trace operator consisting of the volume modulus and one of the heavy modes. And so, you know, view this perspective, you know, the Swan-Dunning distance conjecture is that all the heavy modes are going light as you go to a large volume. You can kind of translate into a statement about the sign of anomalous dimensions of double trace operators.
So the three-point function here is, you said it's between a light and two.
So this distance conjecture. So you say that the KK modes are getting lighter as you go to large volume. So if you've got the modulus which controls the volume, which you call that phi,
So that's saying that the kind of the coupling phi psi psi Bernstein Kawa coupling, which basically is giving you the mass of these KK modes, that the mass has to decrease as you go to large volumes, and saying the mass decreases as you go to large volumes is equivalent to a statement about the sign of the kind of three-point scalar coupling, as that the phi gets bigger, the mass has to get smaller. And then that sign of that coupling turned into a CFT language, you can translate it to a statement about anomalous dimensions of double trace separators.
But if it's in the context of moduli stabilization, I strictly speaking don't have a space of marginal couplings, right?
Yeah, so this would be, you know, so things like the distance, you know, if you want to apply them to actually, you know, to real scenarios, you have like light moduli.
Right.
I don't think it's unusual to say things like the distance conjecture, you know, you still think about them in the context of where you've got light moduli, right? Even though they're not, even though they're not strictly masses.
Mm-hmm. Also, it's not very important to understand what is the nature of those states, whether they are particles or string excitations. So would it be possible to distinguish this from the CFT? I mean, to see what operators are becoming light? What is the density, or I mean, how would you...
I think that's right. You could see that from the density. If you get somehow able to compute the density of operators, whether they come in light, then is it corresponds to a string becoming light or a brain? That's a good indication.
But the answer that you're imagining having control away from the place where the dimensions are decompactifying, right? So, that seems like a step beyond what is normally stated about the distance conjectures, right? So not just that there are some states, and not just that the rate at which they're becoming light is this, but, you know, what are they? That's an interesting question, but it definitely seems an order harder to me. In the traditional swampland setting, is that not the case?
Well, it's believed to be that they become weakly coupled. There are the ingredients of the dual weakly coupled description. So there should be some structure, amazing structure, presumably. But
there's also in the approach to the using Dihan's equations, like a first order system. You know, you kind of understand how it flows away from the fixed point. I mean, they usually are simple. Right? Like you get the exponential solutions and the like. So maybe there's a setup in which if you are able to understand what happens in the fixed point, it's not too unbelievable that you can understand what happens close to the fixed point. Any questions?
In the second quantification, you usually know what they are in the first dimension. But my question is very naive. I'm not sure how this translates into the operators or what is exactly. If it's just a matter of the density or how the operator scales.
That's a good question.
Very naive question, since I'm a real CFT dummy, but it's meaningful to ask this question for 2D CFTs, where I assume conformal manifolds are much easier to understand. They're typically there. And I would say I thought much more was known about CFT spectra, and maybe even their explicit formulas, how the spectra depend on the position in the conformal manifold, or is that not the correct statement?
I'd say, if I had to pick a binary, I'd say that's not the correct statement.
Okay.
Because even in the examples the examples of families of CFTs which have a holographic limit, there is no data for how operator dimensions interpolate along the full path from weak to strong coupling. And not only that, but often, even in perturbatively around the weak coupling fixed point, we know very little. So, for example, if you take the D1-D5 system near the orbifold point, there's really just perturbative results for the lifting of some of the higher spin currents to second order in perturbation theory around the exactly marginal coupling that takes you away to the supergravity point. And there's definitely not something like delta of lambda for some operators.
But yeah, I think what he's saying spiritually is correct, like in the D1, D5 that you were saying. So you have so many products of, let's say, K3 as a dual CFT sigma model on that, and the moduli that he would be talking about would be, for example, moduli of K3. And in that context of moduli of K3, we know that exactly the same story happens. That's, in fact, CFT using 2D, just a single K3 we know, and the symmetric product will also inherit that property. So examples of this type, of course, in those cases where we do have simple holographic duals like K3, that aspect of it is known. Of course, there are other directions you could talk about in that, I think, the one that you're talking about, which is not easy. But there are pieces of that which is easy, and those cases provide further evidence. I mean, not evidence, but basically the intuition for that, because after all, this intuition comes from the string theory, where we have talked about Calabi sigma models, and that kind of thing already is a 2D CFT, so we kind of already knew it in a sense from the 2D perspective. So I think a lot of the modulation for the distance conjugate is indeed 2D CFT viewed as a CFT with the worksheet.
A setting where we do have such information is in n equals 4 superiorizing nodes, where planar integrability has given us, say, the Konishi dimension as a function of lambda. I mean, it's not some tidy analytic formula, but it's the calculation's done. So I'd say actually thinking about 2D and seeing if you can get mileage that you can at higher dimensions with respect to these questions has been kind of disappointing for me. It's still hard. But maybe I'll ask some of the ADS3 CFT2 experts in the audience to speak up if they have different opinions. You know who you are. So.
Well, we have now more CFTs that we could ask this question for. So that's all I can say. We know what are the exactly marginal operators that you could study.
Right. I mean, you could hope to study something like a BPS index, which is much better behaved, but the problem, of course, is these are constant. So you want something intermediate, which is not a constant on the conformal manifold, but still easier to study. I don't know, maybe there's...
This is nonsense ages. This is just the topological strings. You have dependence on three-point functions over the whole modular space, of course. But of course, not the massive spectrum. The massive spectrum of non-BPS data is, of course, a difficult.
For
the 2D CFT people, what's the efforts in trying to find the bigger gap than 4 for the CFTs, 2D CFTs?
Sorry, what do you mean?
The biggest known gap for CFTs is 4.
Ah.
So I'm just saying that people have tried to write modular functions and so forth.
People are certainly working very hard, but...
But anything more than 4 is not done?
Yeah, the results are not encouraging. I mean, 4, you're imagining something like monster times monster bar.
I'm not, that's the only example.
Okay, right.
There's not a classical example, it's just one.
People have worked very hard on this.
But the prospect of solving that is still far in the pursuit.
Yeah. I mean, I think the state of the art is probably the paper that Hartman, Rastelli, and maybe Dalamil wrote last spring using these sphere packets.
Right.
Based on sphere packets.
So they bring it down to C over something, right?
Well, they're studying large central charge.
Right. So the gap is proportional to C.
It's still proportional to C. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's good.
It's good. Yeah. It's what you. It's
right.
Kind
it
of
should be C over 12, we think, and analytically it's down to C over 8.5, and numerically it's down to C over 9.1.
Right. But I mean, one might really need to bring in something aside from modular bootstrap. That's what I would suspect.
Yeah. For those who aren't so familiar with this,
sorry, this is kind of in the weeds.
Oh no, not really. I mean, you know, we're all in the weeds together. So there's 9.1. So the modular bootstrap, if you restrict to so-called spinless modular bootstrap, where you say, you turn off tau 1, then this is believed to have been optimized, and the gap to the lightest non-vacuum Virasoro primary is this. Now, the question is whether it can be brought down to this, which is where the mass SPTZ threshold is. So incorporating the full tau dependence in the modular bootstrap has not been optimized. There's a question about whether that would actually lead to this, but I think no one really knows.
So if it's not just modular bootstrap, which other principles could we use?
Well, Moore and Seiberg showed, at least in principle, that crossing symmetry of four-point functions and modular invariance, modular covariance of torus one-point functions is completely sufficient to exhaust the all of the known constraints of crossing symmetry. And so, well, okay, there's your list of things to implement. I think one of the things that Hartman and collaborators argued pretty convincingly in these papers last spring is that at least modular invariance, the S transform, is pretty well exhausted. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't give you 1/12. It gives you 1 over 9 point something. Right? I mean, that was my read of that.
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty convincing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But getting it down from something proportional to C to something not proportional to C seems very... you're not going to do that using just modular.
Yeah, so so I don't know what is the consensus of the community who are trying to prove these bounds, whether what the actual answer is. Namely, do you really believe that there are components with gap more than 4? And if so, why haven't we been able to do any? Not largely just one exam more than 4. That's not encouraging in that sense.
I mean, it's a vast landscape.
No, I'm not saying give you every possible one, just give you one more than 4. It's not a tall order, I was.
It's a very tall order.
If they exist, if typically they go like C, it's not a tall order.
Let me give you an example. There's an analogous mathematical question, which is finding lattices with, which is sphere packing, right? And one way that people study sphere packing is finding lattices. And the number of lattices grows with dimension. It's the only function I've ever seen which grows faster than factorial. So for example, the number of lattices at dimension, the number of even self-dual lattices at dimension 8 is 1, at dimension 16 is 2, at dimension 24 is 24, at dimension 32 is 10 billion. By the time you get to dimension 48, it's 10 to the 120. And so saying, you know, trying to exhaust, like trying to say, you know, whether, so.
No, but why would we have to, my question is that, you know, certainly interested to ask that question, but why should this problem be as hard as that question is within us?
The problem of finding CFDs includes this as a sub-problem.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying it's going to be easy to rule out by construction of possible things. The question is, why is it that no examples of WZW, for example, or some other ones, would have been some examples like these? Right. They just didn't happen to be.
Yeah.
Of course, we can try to ask why they weren't happen to be and what exoticness. So at some point, you either say this is the prior changes to say, oh no, this is not possible, let's disprove it. So, or let's do construction of something. Yeah. So I'm not sure where we are in terms of these module bootstrap techniques. They're not sufficiently advanced to address constructions.
I mean, the point I'm trying to make is that a constructive, like, you know, because the landscape is so vast, just because you can't construct something doesn't mean that you should believe that it isn't out there somewhere.
I didn't say we should believe or not. I'm just saying, what are the attempts in constructing? That's what I'm asking. And if people, and why have people not pushed that direction? And if they are, where are they? Why are they stuck?
Well, there's different directions that are being pushed.
Yeah.
So for instance, there's different directions that are being pushed. So for instance, like in terms of like this moduli space, from the weakly coupled point, we do have a classification of what are CFTs that could be like holographic. So that...
You mean given some symmetry?
We're satisfying some sparseness condition, yeah, for supersymmetric CFT, at the weakly coupled point, I can tell you all symmetric products that are going to give you, like, that might give you gravitational.
They satisfy this necessary condition on the...
Yeah, so there's a set of necessary conditions, and we know what are the marginal operators that you could turn on so that you can explore, like, the strongly coupled point. So that.
You're asking a different question. You're asking what kind of restriction on CFT is holographic dual. Mine is a much simpler question.
Yeah, but like
just construct CFT regardless of whether it's...
Yeah, but that's the point that Alex is making is that it's hard. So we're starting so we're taking a different route and saying like, okay, let's start from a point that at least we can have some grasp on the theories and then maybe try to understand the deformation. But like I'm starting from the...
Maybe I partly answered, but you know, the way that you would build up more complicated theories is by starting with simpler theories. And but typically, if you do something like just take symmetric product or something like that, of simple theories, then every time you try and project out light states, you find new twisted sector states that...
Is that the future or a bug?
Well,
in other words, it's you're viewing it as if it's a problem for that
method. It's a problem. I'm not saying it's a problem. I'm not saying it's a problem. I'm saying that if you want to try and construct theories with large gaps, this is one of the potential obstructions.
Right. So
and you could say this is a universal
problem. Yeah, I would say that unless people have some ideas how to overcome it, by just counting lattices, you wouldn't overcome it. So my question is, what kind of method do you have, or are you exploring, to overcome it? That's my question. And at what level does your prior change that maybe it's more likely that there is no gap? So that's there cannot be too much of a gap. What is it that pushes in that direction? I'm not saying that I haven't constructed proof is one thing. The other thing, you haven't constructed a single example without four is a more challenge. To construct a proof that can never be done is of course much harder than finding one counterexample, presumably.
I would say that 10 to the 120 is a large enough number that I'm very hesitant to shift my priors based on a small number of examples.
But what makes your prior change? Because if you are, what I'm trying to say is that what is the goal of this community in terms of, if you suppose it's true, suppose it happens to be, somebody tells us it's 4. What would it be in your program to get there? That's my question. If it's 4. Because you're not going to be probing that, how would you be able to prove that? Or what is your methodology to get there?
Well, I mean, for example, in this case, you know, bounds that are of order C have a beautiful gravitational interpretation in terms of, you know, C over 12 is the lightest black hole, and then, you know, if you could show that there was a bound of 4, then of course that would rule out theories of pure gravity. If you could show that there's any bound that doesn't scale linearly with C.
I'm saying suppose that's true. What I'm asking is what would... So you're assuming that the answer is that there is going to be pure gravity or something close to pure gravity. Okay, so suppose the set prior is the opposite. What would you do to try to bring evidence in the other direction? That's my question. Try to say it's too difficult. I think
the thing to do is to explore these other variants of the bootstrap constraints. I mean, so people aren't just using modular bootstrap. People are exploring these other things, these four-point function crossing, relations, higher genus bootstrap.
How close are they to improving the gaps? That's the question.
Well, the problem is that they don't always directly address the gap because the other CFT data comes into play, things like OP coefficients and stuff like that. So,
Yeah, in the approach that Alejandro's talking about, they're studying elliptic genera, and you know already there the class of theories that you guys look at has this e to the root delta growth of the BPS states, which is already inconsistent with this huge gap. Obviously, you're looking at a more restricted object, and you're finding at least the sparsest elliptic genera that you're finding have a pretty that question has not been optimized, and the ones you're finding do have lots of light states. Right, and then this gets back exactly to the ADS distance conjecture and whether there's a relation to R symmetries, because these cases have the U1R squared.
So, can I ask, related to the, so you were saying before that the S modular bootstrap has probably been exhausted, do we have any intuitive reason why the S thing was not enough to get us to the black hole threshold? I mean, for instance, there's this paper by Xinjin and Scott Collier. And then sometimes they find that there's bootstrap bounds that you cannot satisfy, and it's they have arguments like there's a little bit of CFT or some such that prevents you, there's no way that you're gonna get something like this. So do we have any intuition or any argument like that why the S modular bootstrap was not good enough to get 1/12? Is there like any partition function that we are not seeing? Maybe it's modular invariant, but it's not a partition function of a CFT which is obstructing this.
No.
Well, there are modular invariant partition functions that are not CFT.
Right.
Partition functions of known CFTs that saturate the C over 12 bound. So you know, right, which are just products of the candidate extremal CFT partition functions of Witten. So you know that just modular invariance is never going to get you better than C over 12.
Oh, right, but one, but the 9.1?
That's just why you're looking at me funny. Okay, but yes.
But the one, is there something like something which perhaps is not fully modular invariant, but which is S invariant that it leaves at the 1/9.1 or something like that?
Not a known one.
No, but didn't the fast modular bootstrap paper construct numerical examples of this?
Ah, okay.
implicitly?
Yeah, but I think, yes, I mean, implicitly in the sense that, you know, you're relying, it's believed that whenever a bootstrap bound is saturated, there's some extremal kind of theory, or maybe class of theories in this case, living there.
It's not necessarily a theory in this case.
But right, exactly. But I thought he was asking if there's some, like a known theory which is sitting there, which is an obstruction. You know, a theory which would be S, but not T modulo invariant, which...
There's no known theories, as far as I understand.
So I think the answer is no.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, just sort of throw it to some functions.
To shift the topic slightly, but stay within 2D, I think one interesting question is whether, how much non-universality in ADS3 black hole physics is allowed? And as a statement about partition functions, you can phrase this in the following way. So given some modulo invariant partition function that maybe satisfies positivity and integrality, all the things you like, you know, can you add to that modulo invariant function under SL2Z, which just has support on the heavy part of the spectrum, and therefore would modify the heavy part of the spectrum alone, given the same light spectrum that you have, whatever it is. We don't really understand that class of functions very well. And more recently, there's been some work in the string perturbation theory world about non-holomorphic modular functions, which has been nice. But whether there exist functions that have Q expansions with the nice properties we like that you could just tack on to some other thing that you might have constructed by modular bootstrap or otherwise, you know, I think it's interesting, and it's a sharp mathematical question about non-holomorphic modular functions, because if there's this huge space that you can always add, in other words, if the light spectrum doesn't just not determine the heavy spectrum, but, like, you know, really doesn't, then I think there's more to understand about how that relates to black hole physics in ADS3, and asking, you know, in the space of mathematical functions, which ones are you really allowed to add? But that space of functions is not so well understood in the first place.
It's quasi-crystal. But I mean, this is, I think, something that isn't terribly well appreciated, but S invariants, if you phrase everything not in terms of conformal dimensions, but the Liouville momentum, S invariants means that the spectrum is invariant under its own Fourier transform. And the spectrum is a function with delta function support. And we have a name for a function with delta function support whose Fourier transform has delta function support. It's a crystal if it's periodic, or a quasi-crystal if it's not. So the set of, so if you want something with support only in the uncensored regime, with like the heavy states, then that means it's literally a function with delta function support, whose Fourier transform has delta function support. So it's a quasi-crystal. And, you know, so you could try and apply all of the mathematical tricks that people use to study quasi-crystals to understand this. But there's a whole zoo of such things. I think actually, yeah. I think that Fernando Alde had a paper 2 months ago on these Rademacher approaches to 2D CFT that I think is a valuable step.
So yeah, that paper sort of tried to understand the sense in which the light spectrum determines the heavy spectrum, but yeah, you know, you'll never be able to answer that. Right, of course it doesn't. Or I mean, of course the answer is at least we don't know, because this space of functions I just described is unknown. If you can add something that just has support in the heavy spectrum, then the answer to that question is no. But the extent to which you can do that and how many functions there are has not been classified.
But the fact that there are such functions is true, right?
Sorry, one question. So in that paper, the functions that are added, they're not delta function supports, or are they?
They have the same feature that a lot of these other things have, which is where if you try and determine the heavy part of the spectrum in terms of the light part, you find that the heavy part is continuous, and then you need to do something to it in order to resolve it into a discrete spectrum. And the general theory of how to do that is still not very well
understood. So we don't know too much about that. Because I guess you could say the same as well, you know, about the ordinary S modular bootstrap, right? Like, just with the S transformation, nobody is imposing discreteness of the spectrum, right?
Yeah, and then integrality is yet another condition, which it's very hard to impose. Come on. Well, we could talk all day, but things seem to have come to a close, so.